We're talking about the child who goes to bed hungry, the family who has just been evicted from their home, the young man who just survived an overdose, and the single mother who's looking for a job.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. That was Gina Marsh, the chair of the Human Services Chamber of Hamilton County. She was one of dozens of citizens who spoke at one of three public hearings this week on the proposed city budget. City Council and the mayor now have to work out the final budget by the end of this month. To discuss the state of the budget negotiations, the proposed music venue on the banks, the status of managing the Metropolitan Sewer District, and the ongoing inquiry into the death of Kyle Plush, we are joined today by WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, WVXU reporter Bill Reinhardt, and digital reporter for WCPO Paula Christian. All of you, welcome. Glad to have you here on, on Friday.
Thank you. Thanks for having us,
Hello.
Dan.
Okay, Cincinnati budget. Let's begin. Jay, you've been to a lot of these hearings between that when citizens finally get to testify and make their points. How did it strike you this year? Any differences between with earlier years?
This year, I was impressed by the turnout. Generally, council members are listening to half-empty gymnasiums or rooms, and there's usually maybe a handful of speakers, 10, 20, 30. But this year, I counted about 180 speakers at the public hearings on three nights. All of them were standing room only, and it was a pretty diverse group of people and the topic. Sometimes you get a lot of turnout on one topic, but this one I always keep up my little hashtag tally sheet, and it was pretty evenly divided among a handful of topics that people want their funding restored.
So what were the topics that people heard being treated?
Well, I would say the largest groups, and Jay, please correct me if I'm wrong, Cincinnati Works had a large contingent there. This is a group that fights poverty by putting people, finding them jobs. The neighborhood councils from all over the city came because their funding is facing cuts. And this is money that's used for things like little block parties and festivals. The neighborhoods can decide how they want to use it. And
no one neighborhood gets very much.
This is small amounts of money.
Right. But it leverages a lot more. Yeah. Right. That's the key, I think, for most of these neighborhood groups is they turn $1 into $5, $6, mm-hmm. $7, $8.
So what else?
The Port Authority, which is kind of unusual. They usually don't go to these budget
So was the
hearings.
Port Authority board people there? Was it
They had
was
some
it
regular people,
people
there. They had board people. They had some regular people.
I thought it was odd,
well.
Too. The Port Authority actually had a couple of ministers that actually spoke in favor of the, Port
they
Authority.
They had so a couple of people spoke in favor of historic preservation, of preserving old buildings in the land bank. And then the Center for Closing the Health Gap, which we all expected would be there. And then just a wide group of human services agencies.
Well, there's a the closing of the health gap, Center for the Closing of the Health Gap, you know, that's been one of the more controversial over the X number of years, plus the cuts that were proposed by the mayor, he proposed zeroing it out. So where does that stand at this point?
I think that's the biggest story of the budget this year by far. You know, for years, the Center for Closing the Health Gap has been getting direct funding from the city far more than any other agency. This year, they collected $750,000. They've been the subject of numerous media investigations, a city audit into how they're spending taxpayer dollars. They continue to collect a large sum of city money. This year, the city budget is extremely tight. And the mayor has taken the dramatic step of zeroing them out.
I think it's important to remind listeners why, you know, politically what's going on mm-hmm. here, right? So the center is headed by former Mayor Dwight Tillery, who was once a big-time ally of Mayor John Cranley. He was his campaign co-chair in 2013. They had a major, major falling out in about 2016 over the leadership at the health department. Mr. Tillery had someone that he had in mind. Cranley decided he wasn't going to tilt the scale towards that person roughly, and that was a major falling out. Tillery ended up backing Yvette Simpson for mayor, and and now
– And there are political consequences, there are, as the mayor likes to point out.
There are, and the winner goes – you know, to the winner goes the spoils.
So what's going to happen with that, do you think?
If I had to guess, I don't know that the Center for Closing the Health Gap would like their funding at level that they had this year, which was $750,000. The acting city manager proposed $562,500. Cranley said zero. I'm wondering if there's going to be a strike the middle ground. Now, if they do restore it, though, any amount of money, Cranley used that money basically to prop up other things in the general fund for mm-hmm. in his budget. So things are very tight. There's going to have to be give and take. If they, you know, put the $750 back, you know, that $750,000 that's going to have to come from somewhere else.
And what's interesting is the health gap is fighting for this money. As of yesterday, City Hall had received stacks of postcards from just citizens who'd filled out their name saying, please don't cut the health gap.
These pre-printed postcards.
Yes, exactly.
Fill in your name type of thing.
Let's keep in mind, too, that it isn't the end of history with the 2017 election. There are people who want to run for mayor in 2021, and they would like to have Mr. Tillery's support as well as the people that he is able to conjure together into a political coalition. So,
and no accident that the two of those major contenders are current city council members.
No, not at all.
Well, I think what we were talking about earlier before we came on air is, you know, a lot of these human service groups who are funded through the United Way, they've been quietly very critical of the health gap because the health gap gets so much more money than they do.
Yep.
And they're starting to get a lot more vocal. And if they are willing to be public in their criticism, that could dramatically change things at city council.
And just one, let me throw one other thing on the human services that adds to it. Last year, council passed an ordinance that they would get to 1.5% of the general fund budget directed toward human services. And this year, there's an ordinance that says it's supposed to be 1% of the city budget. Neither the acting city manager or the Cranley proposal were anywhere close to that. They were, I think the mayor's was about $700,000 away. The target that the human services groups are looking for is just about $4 million. And that's another $700,000 that if they follow their own law, they're going to have to come up with to plug the budget.
One last question on this is there's potential cuts across all sorts of sectors. What about fees? I mean, there are possibilities. There's been talk about
raising fees. And nobody's complaining about the fees this year.
There were a couple people that came to the public hearings complaining about the extended changing the parking meter rates and extending the hours. But I think they weren't more than five.
Mm-hmm. That is so stunning to me. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But in 2013, the neighborhoods were setting their hair on fire over the parking lease plan and the extended hours in the neighborhoods, the increased rates. That's all happening in this budget. All happening. You know, they're going to have to, you have to pay in neighborhoods till 9 o'clock. You're going to have to pay 50 cents an hour more. And it's, you could hear a pin drop on it.
And
so it's pretty funny.
And nothing was mentioned about the booting.
Last year it was vetoed.
Right.
The parking booting. Everybody was in arms over the parking booting. And this year it's crickets.
Yep. There you go. Let's move on to another topic, and that is the bank's music venue. You know, the Bengals say they don't want to kill the music venue. They just don't want it on lots 23 and 27, very close to them. They want it over on lot 24. So, Bill, what's the big deal? Where it exactly is?
Well, apparently the Bengals are not happy with that location because they say it will interfere with tailgating. But the original concept for finishing out the banks would have what is now parking space and tailgate areas would have that as green space. And you really can't pull your orange and black school bus onto grass and tailgate there. So I don't know what the deal is.
I think it's more than the tailgating, and I don't know exactly what I'm looking into it, but I don't think the tailgating is the whole story there. It's interesting to me that the Bengals really don't want, or they really want this music venue to go on to the lot that is supposed to be residential. It's been planned to be residential since the beginning of the banks, or since they first crafted the plan for it. You know, it's really a head scratcher, but that I think is the most important point is that they don't want, you know, they want that music venue where the people are supposed to go. They're supposed to
live. Now, if you listen to Todd Portune, County Commissioner Todd Portune, the Bengals are not going to be a problem at all. They have no right to veto anything. They're not threatening to veto anything. Now, if you listen to Mayor John Cranley, he's saying the Bengals are threatening to veto and they're going to ruin the whole project.
Well, let's just raise this simple question. From a legal point of view, who's right here? Do the Bengals have a legal right to veto this?
I believe they've got the right. They've got some rights.
They have a right for a seat at the table to discuss the height variations.
The height variations.
But they could, if they sued, they could just tie it up. They could tie this up in court for years, so there would be no music venue. Or they could just use it as leverage for another negotiation with the county.
Well, let's face it. That's on everybody's mind. You know it's on the Bengals' minds. You know it's on the city and the county's minds that they're going to have to renegotiate this contract, extension of the lease of the stadium. So who makes what friends in this situation by making a mess of and a hash of the music venue?
Right. You know, to Bill's point about the legality of this, the city, if I remember correctly, aren't they limited to two stories on that lot right next to Paul Brown Stadium?
Two or three. I thought it was three.
And of course, the music venue, when you look at a photo of it, the floor plates are pretty tall. So it's probably actually about four stories, maybe more than that.
And right now, the couple things that I thought were telling this week from the mayor's perspective, basically, I think he's resigned to the fact that it is going to be the CSO.
But he wants it to be Promo West.
He wants it to be Promo West, but he said it as much at the council meeting this week that, you know, there's no doubt that it's probably going to be the CSO. His questions were, where's it going to go and how are you going to pay for it? Because remember, to do this, there has to be a parking garage underneath of it. If they use lots 23 and 27, there's no parking garages there yet. And
someone's got to pay for that.
The city and county have been paying for those jointly. If the city doesn't contribute money, I think there's a $20 million gap. And Cranley's point is that
they don't have the money for it anyway.
They don't have the money for it anyway. And if they do pitch it in, then they want part of the parking revenue money that the garage generates.
I think what the mayor is afraid of is that nothing is going to get built at the banks for years, and that Promo West is going to go somewhere else in the region and have a concert venue that competes.
And in fact, maybe over to the West End near the new FCC stadium, right? And it just cut the banks out of the whole thing?
Or maybe across the river at in Newport. There's a big piece of land over there that we looked at for the stadium, for the FC Cincinnati stadium.
And then then what happens to the banks?
Right.
I am curious about why, and Councilman Chris Seelbach brought this up this week, and I actually tried to explore this a little bit, but I am curious why the city does not start to play hardball with the Bengals when it comes to that tailgating. There is some conjecture, I guess, that the tailgating, the drinking at the tailgating is not exactly legal, and you cannot drink with an open container on public property. That's something that Seelbach asserted. I asked the spokesman for the Cincinnati Police Department this week whether that was in fact the case, whether the tailgating was legal. I received no response to that question. So I'm curious whether that's something in the city's back pocket.
I want to clarify one more thing. If the Bengals, one of their suggestions seems to be is push this to lot 24.
Right.
But because this has been awarded to the CSO not-for-profit organization, and Lot 24 was slotted for residential development, which would pay real estate taxes, there's a double whammy there. So if this got pushed to 24, they're not going to pay any real estate taxes, and they're not going to get the residential development.
Putting it on Lot 24 is a terrible, terrible idea, and because they need more density at the banks.
Chris, I'm out of time, but I just got to ask you this question. You wrote this column yesterday where you raised the question whether the people making the decisions, city council, the joint committee on the banks, county commissioners, we're just a bunch of old guys like me who don't know a darn thing about music.
And I didn't put it quite that impolitely, Dan.
But that's what it came down to. And they don't know anything about this, and they shouldn't be making these decisions.
So what I did was I quoted the guy who heads Promo West, co-founded it, Scott Steinecker, who said that in a bank's joint steering committee, one of the people making the, or, you know, helping the city and county making this decision. And he wouldn't say who.
I know who said that.
He wouldn't say who publicly, either at the session or after, you know, on the record anyway. He said, you know, what's a Jack White? And of course, Jack White is one of the biggest stars in rock today. And that's exactly the kind
I
of
knew
person.
That. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
right.
I'm sure you knew it. And you would expect them to book bands like that down there. And you had people steering this decision who had no idea who Jack White was.
The city and the county are in agreement on the new music venue. But when it comes to moving forward with reorganizing the Metropolitan Sewer District, the city and the county are having trouble getting on the same page. We're joined today by WVXU reporters Jay Hanselman and Bill Reinhart, Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick, and WCPO reporter Paula Christian. You can join our discussion at 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Or we're on Facebook and Twitter. Well,
I want to say up front, I'm going to recuse myself on this topic because the letters MSD are Bill Reinhart's three favorite letters of the alphabet. Oh, yeah.
Well, let's start with Bill then.
Poor Bill.
Thanks, Jay. Thank you.
Bill, the agreement supposedly that under the supervision of Judge Barrett, Michael Barrett, came about last July and August. City and the county seemed to have an agreement that not only was the county going to own MSD, but they were going to operate MSD almost a year later.
We're not there yet.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, part of the agreement that council and commission approved last August was that the MSD workers will be county employees, but they'll stay on the city's pension plan. And in order for that to happen, you've got to have state approval. You've got to have OPERS, the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System approval. That hasn't happened yet. And we keep getting assured, oh, yeah, just any day now, we've been talking with legislators. We've been negotiating. OPERS is reviewing everything. They are going to give us an answer one way or another any day now. And you ask, well, which way are they leaning? We don't know, but we're optimistic is the answer. So that hasn't happened.
And there's a deadline here of June the 30th. They have to come in with...
Well, June 30th, that's the phase two of the consent decree. The 1968 agreement that split, that gave the city operational powers over MSD, that ends in September.
Actually, it has already ended. It ended in April,
and they had to extend the extension.
Well, they're waiting to see if...
And we know that up in Columbus...
Let's not complicate this any further.
We know that in Columbus, the Ohio House has been sort of frozen for 7 weeks, and now they're unfrozen, I guess. But how fast, when OPERS gives its opinion, how fast can this move anyway?
That's a very good question.
And remember, this puts Judge Michael Barrett in a precarious situation because Judge Barrett also worked out the collaborative settlement agreement that sort of salvaged the Cincinnati pension system. So if they don't get this agreement, I don't think there's any way the city is going to sign on if the MSD workers don't get to stay in the city pension system.
Because
it would bankrupt the pension system, and that agreement that they worked out 2, 3, 4 years ago would completely fall apart because you can't take that number of employees out of the system and expect it to work.
And this would be totally unique for OPERS to permit this, right?
Yes.
I don't think any place else in the state would have this.
Well, so Cincinnati is the only city in the state that has its own pension system yet.
Well, right? That's true.
Still. Yeah. You know, this week, on two occasions, I felt like I was watching the Monty Python dead parrot sketch where, you know, first with the music venue and then with this MSD deal, this is a dead deal walking. From the beginning, I've kind of thought, my gosh, the Ohio legislature has of late, it's not a body that helps out cities, particularly urban cities like Cincinnati. So I've never thought that they were going to give the city and the county a pass on this and let these employees move from one way or the other. But, you know, sitting in this court hearing on whatever day was it Thursday, Wednesday. You know, Judge Barrett was just kind of hilarious to watch. He's like, what are you guys doing? I mean, it was like kind of watching a layperson sit there and be like, and that's kind of how we all have been about MSD over the last 4 or 5 years is, How come these guys can't get any of this figured out?
But he's a federal judge. Can't mm-hmm.
He
does
will.
Have a lot of
yeah,
power.
He
does have a huge amount of power. Yeah. And he's just kind of declined to exercise it is what it looks like to me.
Well,
but he's
I think
warned
he's
them.
Have to. Yeah.
He's warned them if you don't start cooperating and hammering out some of these details, then I am going to step in and you're probably both not going to like the decisions that I make.
Well, the city and the county do not get along. They are incapable of coming up with agreements that stick, that aren't revisited. It's a continuous power struggle. If you read the emails associated with this court case, it's this constant back and forth. We don't have to go to that meeting. You're not the boss of me. And, you know, it sounds
that's
like
literally what the memo said.
It's like, you're not the boss of me. I don't have to go to that meeting. Sounds ridiculous.
Well, Bill, since you're the MSD expert, is there some point of sanity between the county and the city? Is there somebody who's at MSD or somebody who's a little bit above this, who's trying to get this worked out?
You can answer now.
I'm thinking. Well, we are now on the third director of MSD for this year. Gerald Checo retired earlier this year. He was replaced by Jerry Wilkerson, who is now replaced by Diane Christie. She is the interim. So the folks at MSD, they're doing what they can, but they can only do so much. They're caught in between because inevitably they're going to be working for the county. But right now, they are still told what to do by the city. So,
well, on the question of the consent decree about what needs to happen with stormwater and sanitary sewers, there is a deadline there.
That is June 30th.
If this isn't worked out, I mean, somebody has to come forward by June 30th with how they're going to move forward with phase two of this, right?
Well, as Commissioner Portune says, there's not a lot of difference between the city's proposal for phase two and the county's proposal. It's just about timetables. The county says, hey, we've got a 5-year plan, and then we've got some ideas about the 5 years after that, the stuff that needs to be done after that. The city says, no, that's not going to work. Here's a 10-year plan. The county's argument to that is, look, things are going to change. Laws are going to change. EPA regulations are going to change. Needs are going to change. Technology is going to change. Why plan for 10 years out and spend money that you may not need to spend? And the city says, well, on the other hand, if you're not putting these things on paper and planning for them, they may not get done.
The part of the argument that I don't get with that 5 and 10 years, I could see how you could take those two positions and flip who's defending 10 years and who's defending 5 years. I mean, if the county wants to say technology is going to change, the rules are going to change, et cetera, that's not going to happen overnight. That you might need a little longer time to make all of that happen. And Todd Portune himself seemed to say, oh, if we take the 10-year plan, at least we know we'll get it done. But we wanted the 5-year plan because it'll be cheaper.
Well, it's not unlike you look at the national picture and politics right now. Each side says, well, they're doing it this way. And the other side responds with your president did it this way and back and forth and back and forth. And it's just butting heads for the sake of butting
heads.
Look
at some of the same dialogue we've heard in MSD this week. It's the same dialogue that has been said over the Banks music venue. The same fighting between Todd Portune and Mayor Cranley has been going on all week. And it's just like a different subject.
I think it's important to note here that this has gone on through successive county administrations. The Republicans used to control the county commission. They were fighting with the city, and now the Democrats control the county commission, and they're still fighting with the city.
I can remember just recently when the commission changed, when Denise Driehaus got elected, there was this note at City Hall, all things are going to be better now because we've got a Democratic majority on the
we'll
county
tell
commission.
Tell them what to do. I think that was the notion. And
it didn't work.
It hasn't happened that way.
Well, that's what I was going to say. What about Denise in all of this?
Well, two of the county commissioners are former city council members. But that hasn't changed, and they've both been on the commission for a good long time.
They don't get along with each other either.
They get along. They don't always agree, but they get along. And they do work together. I mean, they always have.
But Denise was in Columbus. I mean, she has a different perspective.
Well, I think she might feel like she thought she had a deal with the city, and she might feel a little blindsided that now there's not a deal.
Yeah. Well, one last thing I want to pick up before I let you four go is that there was a little blow up this week where Dan Hills from the FOP lashed out at Ron Plush, the father of Kyle Plush, and said that city council was allowing Ron Plush and a Plush family to dictate how this investigation was going. I mean, politically, that looked terrible. Is there anything from a substantive being around City Hall, anything you can add to that to say what's really going on here?
I don't know that I can weigh in on the politics of it. I thought the most significant thing that happened this week was the fact that there are two independent firms now that are going to come in and do an investigation of the 911 response and the police department response. And hopefully when that investigation is done with its reports and recommendations, that that may give the Plush family what they've been seeking since April 10th. What went wrong? Was there anybody to blame? And what are you going to put in place to make sure that it doesn't happen again?
And what's the timeline?
I think they're supposed to have something done by the end of September.
No, I meant that was the other question that Ron Plush keeps pushing.
That's the timeline on the getting those
changes. On changes. When are you going to implement
I mean, there are things that are underway now. They have like, I think some things are to be implemented 30 days, 60 days, 90 days. But as far as those reports and those recommendations, those are supposed to come out at the end of September.
Okay. I'll comment on the politics if we have a minute.
Sure.
You know, it was kind of stunning to me to see this article that Sharon Coolidge wrote in the Inquirer. I thought it was a really, really good article. But to see Dan Hills protesting something and kind of getting getting his hat handed to him by Jason Williams in the paper later in the week, that was all pretty stunning to me. Dan Hills, I think, and the FOP in general are used to having their way at City Hall. They, you know, when he pronounces things, many council members take it as the gospel of the Lord. And in this case, they're not, because of such a what a politically explosive thing the Kyle Plush death was.
And he didn't know how to read that. Dan Hills didn't.
I don't know that he didn't know how to read it. I think he's doing his job, which is to defend his members.
Okay. Well, I want to thank all four of you for being here. A lot of interesting stuff with both the county and the city. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Editorial writers can write thousands of words on a topic and not get the reaction that a single panel editorial cartoon gets. And that can be a problem in a hyper-divided age of Donald Trump. Under new ownership, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette spiked 19 editorial cartoons by veteran Rob Rogers that were critical of the president and his policies. And then this week, they fired him after 25 years with the paper. To discuss the role of editorial cartoonists, we are joined today by illustrator and editorial cartoonist for WCPO.com, Kevin Necessary, editorial cartoonist for the Cincinnati Business Courier, Joe Hoffaker, and the Cincinnati editor, Cincinnati Enquirer's opinion editor, Kevin Aldrich. You can join our discussion by calling 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome, everybody. And Kevin or Joe, I'll let you sort of get at this first. Rob Rogers, when he was fired earlier this week, wrote online, he said, quote, "The Post-Gazette leadership has veered away from core journalistic values that embrace diverse opinions and public discourse on important issues." What's your reaction to that firing and sort of some of the tensions that are out there right now? Joe, you want to?
It's disheartening and unsettling. This is an age where this seems to be happening more and more. And, the editorial page is exactly what it says. You know, it's supposed to be a forum, a platform for folks to have expressed different opinions and also to hear each other out. So it's unsettling.
Yeah, very much so. And you hope that when a cartoonist is hired, the news organization understands that he or she is bringing an independent voice. But in this day and age, that's not a guarantee anymore. And you know, I think everyone is in this kind of rarefied profession is at risk.
Well, and the publisher, William Block, I think his name is.
Yeah.
Interesting name for a publisher, given the...
John Block, I believe.
John Block.
Yeah.
You know, they inherited Rob, and in some ways you wonder if Rob saw this coming.
Yeah. It sends a troubling message, especially in these times where you have a president who's sort of painting the media as an enemy of the people. And I think, you know, for those of us who work in the industry, I think it sends a very dangerous and wrong message at this time.
But Kevin, I want to follow up on that because, yes, the editorial pages is where opinions and hopefully some competing opinions get discussed, as Joe and Kevin were saying. But it's also the place where the owners and publisher gets to express their opinion. So how much control should the owners and the publisher have over all of the different elements, including an editorial cartoon, on the editorial page?
Yeah, I think, you know, particularly in the newspaper industry where you've seen a lot of evolutions of these jobs. So, for example, we no longer even have a publisher at the Cincinnati Enquirer anymore. That's not even a job classification that exists in our newsroom anymore. But you're right.
We could talk about that,
sure,
by the
absolutely,
way.
Sure, absolutely. But you're right. Historically, the opinion, the editorial sections, the editorial pages have reflected the views of and sort of the political leanings of the publishers of the past. So that has certainly been true. And I think that certainly the publisher, you know, has a right to have a say over the political leanings of the editorial board, the voice that they want to have there. I think that being said, you also, I think, want to create an environment there, particularly when you talk about political cartoonists who are a lot like columnists in a way, where they have their opportunity to express their particular points of view going in. I think if the idea was to create more diversity within the editorial cartooning ranks at the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, there are probably, I could think of probably a dozen different ways that they could have found a way to counterbalance as opposed to, you know, forcing a political cartoonist to draw something he didn't particularly
believe
in.
Kevin, what's your relationship been with the publisher or the editorial page editor or whoever it is you answer to? What's the dynamic there?
At times it's been contentious. Currently, right now, we don't have anyone who is currently running an editorial page or an editorial board at WCPO, just due to a reshuffling. But in the past, yeah, it could be contentious, and there have been times where they have not agreed with my cartoons or my ideas.
And apparently, from reading about Rob Rogers, is the term spiked. That seems to be the term that's used.
Yeah.
Have you had your cartoons spiked over the years?
I have had on occasion, yeah. I have had cartoons spiked, or at least ideas
because
spiked.
Of the substance, because of the point of view.
Yes.
Okay. Joe, what about you? Now, you write for you cartoon for the Business Courier primarily. So it's a business publication.
Right.
So what's your relationship to the publisher?
Very good. I report, with the cartoons, I run those by the editor first, and then the publisher sees them second. In my tenure at the Business Courier, I probably have had a handful, maybe 10 cartoons spiked over the years, but that's before the process really started. So we're talking about rough sketches, just communicating ideas.
And I would like to say that's usually where, you know,
not like you finish your work.
Right.
Right.
Which it's kind of interesting in Rob Rogers' situation. It looks like he's handing in finished pieces, which is really interesting. And I'll play devil's advocate for a little bit here. You know, there's plenty of blame to go around with politics. And I'm not defending the president anyway, but it seems like he, you know, Rob was zeroed in on the president quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I, in fact, in looking at his cartoons and the ones that were Spike specifically, they're really acerbic. I mean, they're very, very pointed.
Mm-hmm.
And he, as someone drawing for a local paper, I was looking at yours, Kevin. Now, you're not with a paper, but you're with local outlet. And Joe, you certainly, I mean, you do, both of you, venture into national commentary, but you do, the bulk of your work is focused locally. He does seem that he was really focused nationally.
And I'm, you know, I do wonder if, at least recently, you know, because his cartoons were being spiked, you know, he was doing more cartoons just on Trump just to see if one would be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, cartoons are or cartoonists can sometimes be contrarians, or, you know, we like to push the limits. That's what we have to do, you know, with our jobs, and you know, it's part of our personality.
And our superiors know that, the people that we work through, they sort of expect that, I think. But Dan, kind of get back to a question that I think you were headed towards, is the business audience of the Business Courier. You know, I've had to learn to speak to an audience, you know, and we certainly understand that. The way, and I hope my bosses aren't listening, but I'm kind of doing an end around on
Jamie.
Trump. Jamie, if you're listening. You know, like last week's cartoon was about the president pardoning himself, but I didn't draw Trump in the cartoon. I drew a little blonde-headed kid, you know. So
is it this one?
That's one, yeah.
Yes,
so,
it has,
so if all the listeners can see that.
Yeah, I know. This is called radio. But a little blonde-headed child is being directed to sit in the corner by his mother, and he looks back at her and says, okay, but keep in mind, I have the power to pardon myself. So, yes. Yeah, Trump's not there, but...
Right. So it's an end around.
Kevin, I want to... We got an email, actually, mm-hmm. just before I came into the studio, and I want to ask this. Mm-hmm. Steve Dieters from Oakley asks, since the Enquirer's Pulitzer Prize-winning Jim Borgman rode off into the sunset, the Enquirer hasn't had an editorial cartoonist. Mm-hmm. They started posting Doonesbury cartoons because they filled a political need. It's not the same. They now print an overview once a week with editorial cartoons from elsewhere. It's not the same. I think we should expect more from the newspaper of record, in quotes, in this town. That is, if they want to maintain that position. What's your response to that?
Yeah, well, I think ideally, you know, the Enquirer is no different than a lot of other media organizations that have had to make some tough decisions about, you know, where to dedicate, you know, resources in terms of covering the community as best they can. After Jim Borgman retired, and of course, everybody was sorry to see him go. The decision was made that, you know, do you want another reporter, or do you want to have a political cartoonist or something else? You know, another reporter on the street covering the community. I mean, these are the kind of decisions that have to be made in economic times. All things being equal, will we love to have, you know, Kevin Necessary or somebody like that at the Enquirer doing local political cartoons for us? Absolutely. But I think that, you know, when you have to make tough choices about where to dedicate resources.
Here's the odd situation I see. The Enquirer, a print publication, still survives. A mm-hmm. lot of them haven't. You don't have a political cartoonist. Kevin, you work for a company, Scripps, that started out as a newspaper company, mm-hmm. doesn't own any newspapers anymore, but they've got you. So you're surviving in the digital world.
Yes.
So that's kind of an interesting turn there that has taken place. We've got a caller who's called in with a question, and I want to make sure that Mark has a chance. Mark, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. I've just noticed with the internet, at least, being much of an echo chamber where people who come in want to hear similar thoughts as what they're thinking, and to some extent that may be happening in the newspaper area as well. I guess my question is, how successful can a cartoonist be to do a crossover, to have satirical or political cartoons that do poke fun in an insightful way, crossing over into a media that may not necessarily accept them? No one has all of the answers to all of the problems, and it may be helpful to allow different thoughts to cross over, but in today's politicized world, it oftentimes just doesn't happen. So that's my question.
Kevin?
Actually, yeah, that's a very good question, and that's, you know, something I've given a lot of thought to, and it's something that Joe and I will occasionally sit around and talk about over beers. But yeah, you know, I mean, the current political and media landscape can be an echo chamber, and something that I know that I've struggled with is if I'm doing a cartoon that comes from a very pointed place, and you know, I think the best cartoons do come from a focused point of view, you know, not trying to do both sides, but you know, you're trying to do just one thing. You do wonder, are you shouting into the void? And I don't know if there's a very good question or a very good answer for that. You know, sometimes I want to spend a lot of time on a cartoon and I want to, you know, throw a lot of detail or explanation behind it. And I know I don't have the space. That's why I've really enjoyed doing cartoons that are comics journalism, where I get to have a lot more space. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if there's a good answer for that.
I think we live in these times, thanks to cable TV, you know, you're being mm-hmm. spoon-fed the stuff that you like. I equate it to, you know, the retailer loyalty card. You know, they know what you love to buy, so they send you coupons to buy more of the same thing, right? So it's kind of up to us to listen and have that interaction with, you know, the other side. You know, I think I've done a good balance in my career of you know, Republican, conservative, liberal, Democrat cartoons. But man, if we run one Trump cartoon, we hear it from people like, you, this is all you say. Well, not really. You just haven't.
Yeah. Was that also true with Obama cartoons during the Obama administration?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's more elevated now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, I was just going to state that, you know, I've really only been doing this for a couple of years. So, you know, I've gotten into this, you know, really right in the thick of the whole Trump era. So
welcome.
Unfortunately, that has overshadowed everything else. Mm. I think, you know, had I been around 10 years ago, I would have done a lot more cartoons lambasting both sides. But I mean, this is just so extraordinary, so, you know, out of, you know, the usual realm of politics that, yeah, it does kind of overshadow. And I apologize, Kevin.
No. I was going to say, to your point, I do think this is somewhat cyclical. I think that, and when you look at our current president that we have, I mean, he's such a big personality. He inserts himself into so many different, you know, news items, and he tweets and he does all of these things that he creates a tremendous, you know, number of opportunities for cartoonists to kind of to take those looks at and do political commentary on it. So I think the fact that we're dealing with a personality who is sort of larger than life, if you will, and is sort of everywhere, he sort of lends himself to that kind of thing.
I've had people ask me, and Kevin, I know you have too. You know, this is a cartoonist dream. You know, this president.
Yeah.
That you have so much material. And in so many ways, it's not good.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe once a month, Joe and I will get together, and you know, we'll sit, you know, we'll have our beers there, and we'll just say, oh God, we're just so tired of having to draw this, or even think about the same thing over and over again.
Well, it's almost like as soon as something's published, it's being it's old news.
Yeah.
he's already moved on to something else.
Yeah. What happens on Monday is forgotten by Wednesday.
Right. What happens on Monday morning is forgotten by Wednesday afternoon.
Yeah.
Or Monday afternoon.
And one of the cartoons I noticed, Kevin, that you did, that historian in me was attracted to, you have a frame. It's just a two-panel cartoon. But you have Thomas Jefferson, mm-hmm. who's speaking the words that he did, that he wrote. Our first object should therefore be to leave open to him all the avenues of truth. The most effectual hereto found is the freedom of the press. It is, therefore, the first shut up by those who fear the investigation of their actions. In the next frame, our president, President Trump, is behind Thomas Jefferson saying, what a loser, sad. And, I mean, that's pretty pointed.
Yeah.
You know, but you almost could footnote that. I think the rest of that paragraph is that Thomas Jefferson said, if I had a choice between a free press and a free government, I would choose a free press.
Well, a free press helps keep a free government. So. And, you know, that's, Yeah, that's what's so scary about these times, especially when you hear, that the press is the enemy. I don't want to speak for everyone here, but I'm going to assume that everyone here, we went into this, with a sense of public service, and civic duty, that what we're doing is something, for the community, for democracy, for the First Amendment. And it's very disheartening to hear our elected officials and then others, including people in the media, echo that we are the enemy. We're not the enemy.
Yeah. Well, you know what I think is interesting about that contrast is Thomas Jefferson, if you go back and look at it, he was no fan of the media himself. He actually had quite a few negative things to say about the media, but even in that, still felt strongly about the importance of the media to the democracy. So if a guy who doesn't particularly think very highly of those of us who do the media still see value in it, contrast that to sort of the messages that we're hearing,
especially
now
during the 1800 election. It was brutal. Kevin, one of the things that the Enquirer does is you do run a collection. I think it's usually four editorial cartoons in the Saturday newspaper, sort of pulled from wherever. Who gets to choose those? Is that part of the editorial board's responsibility? Do you talk about them, or are they thrown a whole bunch thrown on the table, and then you sort of shuffle through them and say, "What's the balance we want here?" How does that happen?
Yeah, so it used to be I used to personally have a hand in selecting the editorial cartoons that that we did every Saturday in the paper. And the process that I would typically go through is there's a repository that we have of political cartoonists from all across the country and even internationally who draw cartoons. And through the service that we subscribe to at the Enquirer, you have access to all of these, and you kind of sort of go through and you look. And I think the first thing that I look for is who's drawing about something relevant and currently, in the news. And once you identify, the topics of interest, then you kind of look for balance. Is there one particular cartoon that has something on this particular issue, and then a conservative and maybe a liberal artist who's sort of drawing it to make sure that you have balance. I look for local first, though, because sometimes you have people who write about, draw about state issues or things of that nature. And so always looking for local, then if not, national issues, and then you look for the balance. Truthfully, one of the challenges has been, particularly with Trump, is that there are a lot of what you would consider to be sort of anti-Trump cartoons that are out there. And one of the challenges that that we were encountering in selecting cartoons was sort of finding a balance. So there was no problem finding artists who had something to say about the president, but finding sort of conservative cartoons that sort of counterbalance that was very difficult. In fact, the service that we use had to start pulling out cartoons that were either not about Trump or that were favorable towards Trump that you could kind of sort of choose from to sort of balance out. So when you're picking four cartoons, now we try to find, there's going to be one Trump that's probably going to be in there. We try to find, one that sort of counterbalances that. And now we're trying to look for at least a couple that have nothing to do with Trump. And that can be a challenge, honestly, in terms of what's out there to pick from.
Well, I want to thank Kevin Aldridge from the Enquirer, Kevin Necessary from WCPO, and Joe Hoffaker from the Business Courier for being here today. Thanks for being here, and continue to be irreverent and make us think. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Leila Shukui is our intern. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website at wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.